Welcome to Roadcase, the podcast that explores the live music experience. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Josh Rosenberg, and I'll be taking you on a journey through in-depth interviews with performers and key people in the industry to explore the magic of live music, how it can be totally transformative for both fans and performers, and we'll look at how they take it all out on the road. It's going to be a great ride, so here we go. Okay, welcome back to Roadcase, everybody. This is your host, Josh Rosenberg. I am so psyched to be here for this episode. Thanks for showing up again for Roadcase. Really appreciate all of you. And I'm really excited to have Mayor Hawthorne on the show for this episode. We had a really great conversation. So that's coming right up, so stay tuned for that. And I want to remind everyone that there's a number of different ways that you can get involved in the Roadcase community. Really quick and easy ways to follow us on the socials. We're at Roadcase Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. As you know, you can also email us at info@roadcasepod.com with your questions, comments, concerns. Really happy to get all those emails, so thanks for sending those in. You can also help support Roadcase by following us on your favorite listening platform on Spotify. It's really easy. There's just a little box that says follow there. Just click on that. On Apple Podcasts, there's a check mark up in the upper right-hand corner. Just click on that, and doing so on those platforms will allow you to receive updates when new episodes come live. Also, don't forget to rate Roadcase on your favorite listening platform as well. So on Spotify, right underneath that follow box, there's a box with some stars. It's easy as clicking on that. And on Apple Podcasts, just scroll up from the homepage, and there's a place to rate and review Roadcase. And you know what to do. So for this episode, I'm really psyched to have Mayor Hawthorne on the show. He's just concluding his most recent tour, Hawthorne Rides Again, and just really, really exciting. I just had the opportunity to see him at Park West in Chicago. Just an amazing show. Great people, great music, and fun times were had by all. Mayor's from Ann Arbor, Michigan, originally, and now lives in Los Angeles. He began his love of music began early on by record collecting in his early age, and he began DJing up in Detroit, and is widely known as your favorite artist's artist, and I can attest to that as well. He's played in support of a number of amazing artists, including supporting Amy Winehouse on her final tour, and has also played in support of Bruno Mars along the years, among others. He's also a producer, most notably working on Doja Cat's album, Planet Her, for which he earned a Grammy nomination. He's a self-proclaimed design freak whose careful curation of his own personal style and music is widely respected and an integral part of his brand as an artist. During the pandemic, his DJ sets on YouTube from his home were not to be missed. He's recently launched the Wine and Vinyl Collectors Club, featuring three carefully selected bottles of wine and a personally selected album, which is very uniquely crafted, as one would expect from Mayer. He's just a fun, affable dude. We had a great conversation. We talked about his background just a ton, and just a ton of other great stuff. I know you're going to love this conversation. His latest album, as I talked about, For All Time, is really a psychedelic ode to love, and I love that. Like I said, he's currently wrapping up his Hawthorne Rides Again tour. You can visit his website for more information on that. As he winds down that tour on the West Coast, he'll be quickly headed home. He and his wife are expecting a baby. So these are exciting times for Mayor Hawthorne, and I'm really happy to have him on the show. Thanks again to all of you for being here, and I want to send a special shout out and thank you to Mayor Hawthorne for being here on this episode of Roadcase, and here we go. Thanks for joining me on Roadcase, man. So we're just talking about interior design, and shit. You had such a beauty. Your house is so awesome, man.
Oh, thanks.
Did you move? Did you move yet?
Yeah, we sold that house, actually, the one that was in all the design features.
Was that sort of a bummer from that perspective? It's such a what a great view that place had.
It would have been a bummer, except that was a fantastic house. We loved that house. but we moved to Pasadena and we like it even more.
Oh, here, cool.
So,
oh, really? What do you like?
And now we're starting on the remodel for this house, which we're having a lot of fun with. I have so much fun with it. I really am an interior design nerd.
You're such a curation guy, you know? It's I'm like from the look to the details. Yeah, it's like no shocker that you know, you'd be into the interior design. Because like before we got on the mic, yeah. I was like, oh, so I want to ask you about your house. Because every time I'm Googling you, I'm like finding you know, out about this gorgeous house that you guys.
That's so funny. Yeah, I think if the music career just ends tomorrow, which it probably will, I will probably just make the pivot to interior design.
Yeah, just like wine collection, vinyl collection, interior design. Yeah. I see a whole syndication of just collaborative curation kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm a detail man.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Wait, so the so that place in East LA, or where was it? Silver Lake or something
that
like
that?
Los
Feliz.
You rehabbed that. Was it like a full rehab or was it just kind of a redesign of some stuff?
That was a pretty full on remodel. Yeah. We did a lot to that. Uh-huh. So we put a lot of work into that place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we ended up, we thought we were going to be there for a long, long time. And we ended up deciding we wanted to have a bigger yard, and now we're actually having our first kid. So,
oh, congratulations, man.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really
Thank
great.
You.
Yeah. 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 How, when is that? What's the date on that?
My wife is due in April.
Oh, fantastic. Psyched, nervous. What's give me the emotional gamut that you're going
I'm so, so stoked, man. I can't wait.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. I got three kids of my own, so they're older. My oldest is 26, and I got a 20-year-old and an 18-year-old.
Oh man, I got some catching up to do.
Yeah, well, good luck with that. Well, you know, hey man, it's a great time. You know, it's an amazing experience. You know,
it's a whole new frontier. I'm really stoked. Can't wait.
Are you?
I can't wait to be a dad. I feel like I've been preparing for being a dad my whole life.
Oh really? How so?
I mean, I've been dressing like a dad my whole life and making dad jokes and, you know, just caring about dad things for a long time.
So. I can see you sitting in a wing back chair, is that what they call it, with a little lamp and a glass of wine and, you know, the smoking jacket.
It's my lifestyle. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so great. That's so great, man. Yeah, well, where are we going to talk? Where are we going to start, man? There's just so many amazing things that you've been doing. But you talked about the house being a part of the pandemic. What was it called? Wine and
Oh, the Wine and Vinyl Hour. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Wine and Vinyl Hour started. Yeah. Kind of just, I mean, it was something I was just doing anyway, mm-hmm. having a glass of wine at 6 p.m. and playing records from my collection.
Yeah.
And we had actually started right before the pandemic. We started doing it live at this bar in Culver City on the rooftop, which and it was really cool. And I would just bring records from my collection and just play them and drink wine for an hour.
Yeah.
And when everything shut down, my manager was like, well, you're doing this at home anyway. Why don't you just turn the camera on and let everybody else join in?
Right, right. Good idea.
it was a fantastic idea. And yeah, shout out to Jackson Perry.
What's your manager?
But it just turned into such a thing.
What was the thing that surprised you the most?
Just that, like, how many people were tuning in every week. And it turned into a thing where, like, people were coming just to talk to each other. And
oh yeah, that's cool.
It started, you know, as like everybody's coming to watch the show, and then it turned into like everybody was just coming to talk to each other and they didn't even really care what I was doing.
Yeah,
it was all about the chat.
Yeah,
the chat room.
Yeah. You became the Facebook of music and the DJ. I don't know.
No, it was such a great
the third place, you know.
It's such a great thing.
That's what
it
people needed.
This whole community.
Yeah. People needed that third place. Because there was no third places really to go, right? There was no second place either. There was just home. There wasn't any work or
there was
place
nowhere to go. Yeah. There was nowhere to go. Right. And I think it really did help people just feel like they had some community and some friendship. Like it was an important thing during that time. And then now we have parlayed that into the Wine and Vinyl Collectors Club.
Yeah.
Which we just launched last week.
Yeah. The first installment's already sold out, by the way. I don't want to discourage people from going to check it out. I went to it and I wanted to find out more information about it.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. We're going to, the first one went really, really well. Thank you so much to everybody who got in on the first wave, but we're getting ready to launch the second one. So
how long has that been like hanging out there? How long did that take to like, sell
this
out?
It's the first box sold out in a couple days. I mean way faster than we thought. We capped the first one because we just wanted to make sure that we could handle everything, and you know, we're still figuring out the logistics of this whole thing, and we didn't want it to get out of control. But it's going so far so good. We got it all.
The footnote with that is that you didn't want to pack all the boxes yourself. You'll just be in your garage just doing everything.
I wouldn't mind that at all. I just want to make sure that we can take care of everybody that wants it. So
So how are you choosing the wines? Tell me about your background. I mean, you're putting wine on here. What's the whole wine thing, man? I mean, so, it's like everyone, so many people love wine. I was going to say everyone loves wine, but clearly that's not true. But, you know, it's like the great relaxing thing. It sort of fits the vibe with the vinyl collection. And there's a very much of an aspect of having to curate your own collection and think about it. It's just not something you pick up.
Yeah, I don't. And I want to preface it by saying that I do not consider myself a wine expert of any kind. I just know what I like and what I don't like. Mm. And that's, you know, and it's a personal choice for everyone.
Right. I mean, it's very subjective.
It's very subjective. And everybody has a different palate when it comes to wine, just like music. And I really do think there are some amazing parallels between wine and vinyl records, down to the label art, and the palette that is very subjective and very specific to each person, each individual.
To the
notes,
to the levels of the potential for snobbiness and in the connoisseurship as well.
Absolutely, yeah. There's that for sure. Let's not forget. Yeah.
Let's not forget that if you get into this, you can be a snob too if you want.
You can be a snob. You can be. I don't know. Yeah, you can be whatever you want.
Well, I mean, that's the beauty of having a great vinyl collection or appreciating music, appreciating live music. The more live music that I listen to, and the more different various genres that I listen to, the more I understand just how it seems basic, but it's just so incredibly subjective. And you know what one person hates, another person loves, and that's kind of the beauty of the human experience, really.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the only way to know whether or not you like something is to try it.
Yeah,
and this is a cool way to just try some things that you might not have tried before or might not.
What is it about music where that creates a platform for haters sometimes, though?
I mean,
it's like the culture that, oh, if you like this, then you're this type of person, right?
Music can be very divisive.
That's a better way of putting it. Yeah,
right? I mean, you know, I always used to joke that, like, if you don't like Steely Dan, I probably don't like you.
Well, you like,
as a person.
When I read that, let's save the Steely Dan thing because we're talking about subjectivity. But once I read that about you and Steely Dan, I was like, yes, finally, someone that loves Steely Dan.
But there are so many people who don't, who just don't get it, or really don't like it.
Okay. All right. Are we going down the Steely Dan road now? Let's go.
We don't have to go down.
No. I want to do it, man. I'm not saying that. That's not a criticism. Like, okay, let's do Steely Dan. Let's talk.
Sure. We can talk about Dan all day, but we might lose some listeners.
I'm sure you'll bring them for me, man. You'll bring them for me. great band. Shit. I go back to them all the time. And ever since, and I finally got a great validation on it too, when I went to see Kurt Vile play at Thalia Hall, and he played, Dirty Work as the I'm Gone music, basically over the PA after he left the stage. That was really sweet. Gave the high five to the sound man for doing that, you know?
Hell yeah.
Man, why is Steely Dan divisive in your mind?
I think, if I had to guess, I would say, for one, it's very sardonic, very wry. The lyrics are tough to decipher, even for a fan of Dan, a lifelong fan of Dan. I still don't know what they're talking about half the time. And then the other thing that I think throws a lot of people is there is a ton of jazz in Steely Dan.
Yeah.
And a lot of people just don't know. It's complicated music.
Yeah. For me, it's a little bit of the glossiness, you know, of it can be off-putting for those because it's really in a rock genre. But again, like you said, there's jazz elements. There's other, there's incredible production, glossy, silky, but just some badass fucking playing too. I mean, if I'm going to play a Steely Dan album, I'm probably going to do Royal Scam because I want people to understand what they can really do from a rock perspective. Because I come at it from a rock perspective.
Yeah.
Right. You know, Kid Charlemagne, right? Okay. You know this.
Of course.
I mean, not the song. Of course, you know the song, but I read, and I kind of, if you read the lyrics, it's about Owsley Stanley, right?
Heard that story. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. For those that don't know, the sort of one of the original creator of LSD in the Berkeley scene back in the 60s.
Right. The test tubes in the scale.
Yeah, just noted for a prime level of LSD then. Who's supplying the dead? He was known as the Bear. That hence he would put the dancing bear on the blotters, right? Something like that, right? So that became the icon. So the icon dancing bear for Grateful Dead is about Owsley Stanley, which in turn is the Steely Dan album. So anyway, yeah, I would take people to Royal Scam. Why do you like that album?
For me, it was just their peak as far as recording quality. It was like the perfect balance between the pop sensibilities and the catchy hooks and riffs, but it was still so interesting. It was like a step beyond what you were getting on what's the first one?
Not Katie Lied.
Oh my God, I'm blanking.
The one that opens with Dirty Work. Yeah, their first album.
First album. Yeah. It was a step beyond musically, but it still was like dirty and raw.
Right.
Before they were still using the real Fender Rhodes and everything was to tape, you know, and it was like before they got way too nerdy with it.
It was
the recording.
Yeah, in a sense, I think it was so their first album was Can't Buy a Thrill, Countdown to Ecstasy, Pretzel Logic, Katie Lied, Royal Scam. It was before they descended into what the haters like to hate is Asia. But there are some incredible songs on Asia that actually you could create Asia with Royal Scam production values and make it a kick-ass rock album.
I mean,
but the way that Asia is just so silky and beautiful. There's some incredible jams on Asia.
I think Asia might actually be a more perfect record.
Yes. But, undoubtedly.
The Royal Scam just it hits me in a special place. I don't know. I the caves of Altamira and those kind of, I just
don't
love
take
that
me
shit.
Alive. Green, yeah, yeah. Green Earring. Whoa.
Green Earring is yeah, incredible.
Shit.
Yeah.
That's just great stuff, man.
It's just good stuff.
But I love how you love to put it out there though. I have not heard that out there. I was like, oh, this guy, I love this guy.
No, I'm a Dan man forever.
And they, you know, I grew up in LA. So I grew up in the Valley in Studio City, North Hollywood area over there. Mm-hmm. And they were hanging out at the time. So I was in high school in like late 70s to early 80s. And I didn't actually lay eyes on any of those guys, but, they were around. That's where they recorded. Larry Carlton, who played on a lot of the of their yes. albums, was yes. at Valley Arts Guitar on Ventura near Laurel Canyon, where I took guitar lessons. So I kind of feel like I have the connection with them.
I was about to just pull my Larry Carlton solo records out for you.
Right. I might note for the radio audience that we're in the we're in the vinyl collection room. It yeah. makes it a lot easier when you got to have that grid pattern, right? Or else you're like floating 1,000 albums to the left or right every time you want to get something, right?
Yeah, the cube cubbies, yeah.
Cube,
yeah,
got to be into cubism as well as vinyl collecting.
to get even more snooty with it.
When I was at I went to UC Santa Barbara just up the road, and I was at KCSB FM, like my first or second year, I think.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, I did AM early, and then I switched over to FM for that summer between my freshman and sophomore year. But yeah, they were not into the cubes, man. You had to like part the seas of like thousands of pounds of records to get into the middle.
And that's a tough way to live.
They always asked you to like make sure you put a marker in, so you put the album back in the whatever wherever it was, because if you wanted an album, you just knew where to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So let's talk about where you grew up. So you grew up in Ann Arbor, in Michigan.
In Ann Arbor, Michigan. Yeah, just down the road from Detroit. Yeah, my whole family. Is my whole extended family isn't, they all are born and raised in Detroit.
Uh-huh.
My parents as well. They lived in off a 6 mile road.
Oh, right down, almost downtown. Right. I mean, I don't know Detroit yep. enough.
Yeah.
Intimately,
right there. Yeah. And, we moved to Ann Arbor when I was young, and then I grew up mostly there. But, and then once I turned, 18 or 19, I started going out to Detroit and DJing out there. And then I would spend more and more time in Detroit. But Ann Arbor was such a cool, diverse, hippie place to grow up. It's a very progressive town. It was, you know, home of the Hash Bash, the biggest marijuana legalization rally. Oh. That we used to have every year. I used to make like 100 grilled cheese sandwiches in my parents' oven, and I would ride my bike around the Hash Bash and sell grilled cheese sandwiches to all the stoners.
That's nice. Yeah. Yeah.
But it was a really diverse place, man. A very cool place that has a very rich musical history. I mean, Iggy Pop went to my high school.
Oh, really?
So did Bob Seger.
Wow.
And no there's shit. a lot of rock and roll there, a lot of folk music, MC5.
Uh-huh.
And then even like later on, I discovered cats like Travis Biggs, who was like more of like a soul harpist, and you know, it was there was just so much down the road. I lived in Ypsilanti for a little bit, which is a town, the next town over where Eastern Michigan is, and
wow,
there was a group called the 24 Karat Black that recorded there, that is like a very rare sought after soul record. Jeez. Now that it's been sampled by Dr. Dre and Nas and a bunch of people, and you know, it was recorded right down the street from me. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And your parents, were they, what were they like? A musical? How was your upbringing? Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have two younger sisters. Yeah. Okay. But my parents were both big music fans. They both had big record collections, and my dad still plays bass guitar and sings in a band to this day. He's 72 now, and he still rocks.
No kidding. What kind of band? Like, what does he play?
They play classic rock covers mostly, but and it is so much fun. Like, I try to go see them anytime that they're playing.
Well, let's give them a shout out. What's the name of the band?
The band is called M22 now.
Right off the M22, conveniently located.
Off the M22 freeway. Yeah. Yep, in northern Michigan, yeah.
Right.
So he taught me to play bass when I was really young, and he's but he never pursued music as like a career. It was always just like a fun hobby for him.
Uh-huh.
And my mom is also, you know, she was really into musical theater and was in a lot of musicals performing, and worked at the Fisher Theater ticket booth. Like, she would sell tickets to the shows when she was younger. I mean, yeah, she loves musicals, and she's a great singer. So,
right.
Yeah. I definitely get it from them.
Yeah. So were you into, like, your dad, you said your dad was collecting, were you like going through his albums, playing, did he let you play his albums? Did he let you fuck with his turntable?
Yeah. He was very cool about that. They were not precious about it. They were like, yeah, go for it, man. They would buy me one of my dad's best friends growing up was a radio disc jockey.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked for like one of the local radio stations, and they would send, like, all the record companies would send all these promo records to the radio station to try to get the record played.
Uh-huh.
And he would bring over like anything the radio station didn't want. He would just bring it over and give it to me.
Oh, nice.
And I remember just being, you know, having like Stevie Wonder 45s and Queen, Another One Bites the Dust on 45.
Like, would it be one of those demo albums that they would like stamp demo on it, or like put a hole in the cover so you couldn't resell it? Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Right, I remember and those. Then a lot of 45s, just like singles. Oh, and I would just sit like all day long and with my little Fisher Price record player.
Yeah, what? How old are we talking here? How old were you?
I mean, I probably was, 5 or 6 years old.
Right.
Or less, maybe.
With your little cardigan sweater and a pipe and a whole smoking jacket kind of thing.
My like, bubble pipe. Yeah.
I see an SNL skit here somehow. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool, man. So you're putting it together and you're doing DJing. Well, tell me like a first like DJ kind of like experience that you did like as a kid. Did you like gather the kids around in the neighborhood and do this thing, or what would that
well
like?
I played a lot of sports in high school.
Oh yeah, so did I. What was your sport?
I played basketball. I played lacrosse, golf.
Oh, cool.
You know, flag football, whatever. Yeah. Everything. Soccer. I played soccer for a hell of long too.
Right.
But I was, it was really like all the guys I would play basketball with in high school, they started a rap group.
Uh-huh.
And I really wanted to be part of this rap group so bad. I wanted to join their rap group. And they were like, well, we already have enough rappers, we don't need anybody else, any other rappers in the group, but what we really need is a DJ.
They didn't tell you, well, we've been really looking for this Jewish kid, we wanted to fill up the Jewish slot in our band, in our
I don't think they were looking to fill any slots at all, but I was determined I was going to be a part of this group with my basketball player friends, and they were like, all right, well, what we need is a DJ. So I was like, bet. I went on eBay and I bought a used pair of Technic 1200 turntables. And I bought like 6 or 7 records that I had some 45s or whatever, but I bought a couple of rap 12 inch singles, and I just locked myself in my room for like a summer. And just practiced every single day, like mixing and scratching and blending and and they let me join the group. And I was the DJ for this rap group called AML for all through the rest of my high school and into college. And I DJed in local clubs. And then even when I moved out to LA, that was what I did. I was DJing in clubs for, you know, $50 and dinner a night.
Nice.
Just to make ends meet, man, to pay the bills.
Yeah. So how'd that go? Were you able to do that? Did you make ends meet?
Yeah. And, you know, enough to where I could like scrape by. And I would do like odd jobs here and there. I don't know, anything I could do to survive, to pay the rent. LA is expensive, man. But we had a really cheap apartment in Culver City that I shared with another guy. And it was crazy times. We had so much fun though. It was just like it was such a fun time to just explore.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about just your style of DJing and different various styles of DJing. Are like, I see guys with that where it's like super electronic and they're at a console doing crazy sounds and all that kind of stuff. Are you even to today? What's your definition of what your own DJing style is? Is it you've got vinyl up there? You know, you talked about blending, which I assume just from my own DJing days at a radio station, you know, just kind of bringing it in nicely and mixing up the different sounds, having two turntables. Tell me a little bit about how that works for you and your own personal style and where it came from.
I mean, I've done so many different types of DJing. I mean, when I started DJing for the rap group, I was mostly like supporting them, you know, playing the right song at the right time that they could rap, the right beat that they could rap over.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, putting routines together. And I was very at the time, like, you know, you had the Scratch Pickles and oh my God, who were there? DJ Q-Bert and like all these guys that were like Cut Chemist, you know, all these dudes that could scratch really well. And they would like make all these cool sounds scratching. And I really tried hard to learn how to scratch like the Beastie Boys. You know, I wanted to be able to make all those sounds, the crab scratch.
Because there's actual like physical technique in doing that.
Yeah, there's a lot of physical technique. And then, you know, I never entered like competitions for it, but there were all kinds of DJ competitions, and dudes would do like crazy routines where they would juggle two of the same record back and forth. And
were there like, are there like different categories or silos of DJing? Like, is it like,
man,
literally
so
like
many.
Here's the scratch category, here's the this category, like what
there's
what
is- so many. And I kind of like, I don't really pay that much attention to that anymore, but right. I was very into cutting and scratching back in the day, and I would do it, you know, record my own little mixtapes and do all kinds of little scratch routines in between songs and stuff. And but then like nowadays, I mostly when I DJ, I try to only spin vinyl whenever I can. Mm-hmm. And it's much more about curation and selection now than it is technical ability. But you still got to be able to read the room. You know, when I DJ, mostly my goal is to try to get people moving.
For sure.
And
yeah,
you want to, I like to get people dancing and moving, and
right.
And you got to know your records really well. You got to know the BPMs of your records and which record is going to sound great coming out of this record. And
yeah,
you know, how to keep the groove going and keep the vibe steady so that you don't lose people and they go, or not,
you know, however you want to structure your set, right? I mean, you can bring it down. Are your sets just kind of generally at that higher level of energy the entire time?
It really depends. I mean, you just gotta, as a DJ, like the most important skill, I think, of all is just being able to read the crowd.
Yeah. It's like, what do these people want? What's the vibe? What are they bringing? What are they wanting?
What do they want to hear? What's going to get them in the mood, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. But it's, yeah, clearly it's a form of live performance. I mean, it's you're up there, you're doing it, you know, you're reading the room. In fact, you might have more flexibility as someone that's got, you have your fingertips on any music you want. So you can create a really unique vibe that somebody, you know, coming in may not have thought was even going to happen at that night. Like, completely.
Yeah. When I DJ, I'm always trying to introduce people. You know, I want to keep the party going, but I do always want to, as much as I can, push the boundaries of what people know and what they're comfortable with, mm-hmm. and maybe expose them to something cool that they didn't know before.
Well, is that a conflict to reading the room, though? Are you reading the room and going, no, these people need to learn about something new?
I mean, it's really, if you're good at it,
yeah,
you're able to ride, hopefully you're able to ride that fine line,
right,
and
subversively, you know, enter, push your, right, own, like, right, sort of, exactly, borderline kind taste.
Kind
of
push your own agenda.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Mind control. It's the ultimate mind control.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It is. It's controlling the party. It's moving the crowd. It's that. Yeah. That's, yeah. MC stands for moving the crowd.
So, let's talk about your, so we've talked about vinyl. You've got the wine and vinyl collection. Clearly, you know, there's a lot to that from where you're kind of coming from, but your albums are a amazing amalgamation of soul, funk, disco. No, I wouldn't really go that direction, but
oh, I would.
Would you? Okay.
Yeah, all right, for sure. But,
I mean,
I love disco.
You tell me about where are you on the spectrum of having live players? Cause you're going out, you're also going out on tour starting January, you know, you're touring around, mm-hmm. the world, you know, tell me about that transition from DJing to, no, I want to play, you know, I want to be in front of, I'm going to get my friends, my musician friends. We're going to get up on stage. We're going to do this live. When, like, what does that organic process sort of look, or what does that process look like? And is it kind of, was it an organic transition for you?
I think having that DJ background was really crucial for me. Because when I go to put my live show together, mm-hmm. I always arrange the set as if it were a DJ set. Mm. And there are ebbs and flows and, you know, peaks and valleys. And I'm creating seamless transitions from one song to the next, mm. that we're doing, but we're, you know, playing it live.
Yeah.
And just like I would if I was DJing. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how, you know, how much that matters when you're trying to keep a party going. I mean, yeah. I remember seeing James Brown perform at the, at Hill Auditorium. In Ann Arbor, Michigan.
I saw the National there a couple of years ago. Yeah, great intimate theater venue.
Very,
holy
very
shit.
Cool. Yeah,
James
very
Brown.
Cool.
Come
venue.
On, man.
Yeah. I saw the Godfather of Soul perform live, and he was getting up there, but he still had it. Man, did he
maybe
have
fewer
it still.
Splits, but he still had it.
Man, he really, really had it still. And every song went like seamlessly into the next song, mm. and into the next song. And it was like, the whole thing felt like a DJ set to me. Mm-hmm. And it was all so well, it was so formulated and it was so tight.
Yeah.
And there was like nothing left to chance. It was like not, you know, it wasn't, you know, within each song and each groove, there was room to play around, but it was regimented, man. And that's how I like to put my shows together.
Yeah. Tell me about that transition period. So you came to LA, you're still DJing, you're doing that thing. What did it look like coming into kind of a first album with a band?
So to make a really, really long story short, I met a guy named Peanut Butter Wolf at a party here in LA called the Do-Over, a big like day, Sunday day party that all the cool people used to go to. And I knew Peanut Butter Wolf from his record label. He had he runs a record label in Los Angeles, a very cool independent record label called Stone's Throw Records. And one of my former label mates in Detroit, a guy named Jay Dilla, a producer named Jay Dilla, he had just moved to LA and signed to Stone's Throw. And I was like, I knew a couple other artists on Stone's Throw Records that I thought were really cool. And so when I met Peanut Butter Wolf, I was like, oh, here's my chance. And I gave him my demo of my rap beats. And he was like, yeah, these are not good, man. He did not like my rap beats at all. He thought they were totally whack. But he was like, what is the music that you're using, that you're sampling to make the beats? What is that? And I was like, oh, that's just this thing I did in my bedroom. It was, you know, music that I made, like soul music that I made, right, so I could sample myself royalty free so I wouldn't have to pay for the sample clearance.
Smart. Yeah.
And he was like, well, that's cool. That shit's good. You should do that instead.
Right.
And even then I thought, okay, well, you know, if you're going to put it out, great. Like I'll do it, but then I'll just go back to making my rap beats and being a hip hop producer.
Yeah.
And a DJ.
Right.
And we put the first record out and it just went. And
nice.
I was like, oh shit, I guess I'm not going back to be, I guess.
Was that the first album as Meyer Hawthorne? As Meyer Hawthorne?
Yeah, that was the first Meyer Hawthorne record. And that came out in 2009. And it ended up just being way bigger than anybody thought, including Peanut Butter Wolf. I mean, nobody could have predicted how big it would go. And then all of a sudden I had to put a band together. I had never put a band together. I didn't know how to do that or anything. So I was like, oh God, I need to,
figure
all this out.
So did you so you gave your info to this producer that you met at this, the really short story is that you gave your info to a producer at a party that you met in LA. Like yeah, that's a tale. That's a fantasy tale as old as time.
It's straight up fantasy. Yeah.
That's fucking amazing. Tale. So wait, you didn't know the guy was going to be there. Did you know who he was when you got there?
I did know who he was. Yeah. But barely. I mean, I had never met him before. Right. I mean, I'd never seen him before. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
So were you like fucked up when you were at the party?
I got introduced to him by another friend.
You kind of made it happen in terms of like trying to get in front of him. Like in terms of this particular event, this seminal, like cool, fucking iconic type of event.
Yeah, it was definitely a special time in LA for music, man.
For you,
it was a really cool scene that was happening at that time.
Yeah.
There was a real community of LA musicians. It was a very cool scene.
Is it different now for some reason? I mean, clearly musical tastes have changed, directions have changed, obviously, but I mean, I would venture to say there's a party and there's people getting together and you know that.
I would hope that there are similar things going on now that I'm just not going to because I'm too old now, but I'm sure there are very cool things like that happening.
Yeah. 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 It's interesting. It kind of just happens when it happens and when you're of the particular age and you meet somebody. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you started to do that. So you had to get a band together. So what the fuck were you like going to like,
I called a bunch of my friends from Detroit and I was, they had been in like various bands. And some of them had played together and some of them hadn't. And then I was like, will you guys be my band? And they were cool enough to agree. Some of them had already moved out to LA and then some of them were like, well, I guess I'll fly out and go on tour with you. And it was really, really amazing and fun. Yeah. But we all were just kind of figuring it out as we went along. I mean, we had no idea what we were doing.
Whoa.
Looking back on it, I mean, I had never sang lead in a band ever. I had no experience being like the front man of a band. It was a crazy time. And look, I watch videos on YouTube now. There's videos, unfortunately, of everything and everybody.
You're going back and watching your old shit, man. Fucking balls, dude.
Well, I don't do it on purpose.
Don't smoke it up and do that, man. That could be dangerous.
Every once in a while, I'll catch a video of myself from like when I first started, and I just cringe. I'm like, so I can't even watch it. I'm so bad. But it was good enough to like to keep the thing going, you know.
Kept
growing and growing and growing. I mean, you know, it brought a lot of people together, which I think, and it was like a very positive, peaceful vibe that was full of love. And I think that was what kept it going.
Well, I don't want to be too harsh on like going back and looking at early stuff. I mean, clearly it was good enough at the time and to gain some traction, right? But then you've done so much since then you look back in there and like, yeah, of course you're not as good, quote unquote. It's different, right? Like it's interesting to kind of look, you know, it wasn't like it was shit. There were people that you were getting attention at the time, you were going on tour, you were doing the thing.
Yeah, I mean, for like it resonated with people, right? I think a big part of it also was that it was just so different from anything else that was happening at the time. Mm. You know, you had like Amy Winehouse, but there just wasn't a lot of young people making soul music at the time and doing it.
What year are we talking? Oh, so we're talking 2008-ish.
This is 2008. Yeah. Uh-huh. 2009. And it was just, it just didn't sound like anything else.
Right.
That was out there, which I think was a big part of why it worked. People heard it and they were just like, yo, this is weird.
What are you
and different?
Yeah. I want to come back to Amy Winehouse because you toured with her and I want to ask you a couple questions about that. But to what did you attribute? You talked about how there was not nobody out there that was really doing what Amy Winehouse was doing, what you were starting to do at the time. Mm-hmm. But there was a Hall & Oates and there were other bands that late 70s, 80s. There's a gap in there somewhere. What do you attribute that to? And, you know, likewise, why did it come back?
I mean, everything goes in cycles. Yeah, I mean, I everybody forgets. I think now it's really easy to forget, but Hall & Oates went through a period where they were very uncool and nobody was listening to Hall & Oates in like the 90s and the early 2000s. Like it was not cool.
Yeah.
And everything comes back around.
Right.
I don't know. Everything is cyclical. And I just happen to be doing
even the shitty stuff. I didn't mean that about Hall & Oates. No way.
Everything is. Hall & Oates is one of the greatest groups ever. I mean, they're the best selling duo in music.
Yeah.
History.
John Oates is coming out with a folk album, man. He was at Newport last year, and I saw him talk at the Relics Live Music Conference in Nashville earlier this year. And he's super such a interesting cool guy, and you know.
Oates is such a cool dude. I got to do a couple shows opening for Hall & Oates. I played Madison Square Garden opening for them. It was incredible.
Holy shit.
What a cool experience. That was pre-COVID, so probably 2018 or something.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah, but very, very, very cool experience.
Because you're clearly influenced by Hall & Oates.
Oh, yeah.
So that must have been like an amazing experience for you, not only to be at the Garden, but also to be like close to those guys or whatever.
Yeah, you know? Super cool. Yeah. And their crowd also resonated really well with my music. So
that's nice.
It was a nice bonus.
Yeah. So that was a big moment for you. Did you see a big bump at that point?
Yeah, that was really fun. Yeah. And yeah. We did. It was just to, I don't know. Yeah. Just to get to watch those guys play every night, too, was so cool.
Yeah. I mean, not much of an intimate, not a really intimate room, but pretty decent. You played, since we're talking about Hall & Oates, I'd love Live at Daryl's House. And you played that, and wait,
that
you
was
were
a
doing
crazy
I can't do
me.
You did I can't go for that with him in a room with his band. Like, what the fuck? Tell me about that.
It was very surreal. Yeah. He hit me up and was like, hey, do you want to come to the house and do the show? I was like, of course, I'll tell me when I'll be there. And then
Was this right after you opened for them at the Garden?
No, this was way before that.
So this is kind of how they got to know you.
This was early on. This was when I had just dropped. I think I had just released my second album, How Do You Do?
Ah, okay.
So this would be like 2011 or something like that. 2010, 2011.
Uh-huh.
And this was before he even had before the show was even on TV. It was like it was just on the web. It was on YouTube or something. And he just started doing it. This was when he still did it, like, at his house too. And I went to his house in Connecticut and it was so cool. I just remember them sending me like the Hall & Oates catalog on CD or something like that. And they were like, try to pick some songs. Because they asked me what songs I wanted to do, what Hall & Oates songs I wanted to do with them.
Oh, that's so fucking cool.
And they said,
how cool is that for you, dude?
They said, try to pick some more obscure songs that are not the big hits, you know, because we want to be more diverse with what we're doing on the show.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, bet. I can go deep in the Hall & Oates catalog if you want. Let's do Portable Radio. Let's do, you know.
Uh-huh.
Let's do oh my god, what's the
I can't go toe-to-toe with you on this like I can with Steely Dan.
Man, there's so many great deep cuts. And I remember like throwing a bunch of them out of there, and they were like, well, let's just do Private Eyes. and then we ended up just doing all the big hits, which was funny. So funny. Yeah.
It sounded great in theory, but then when he like pitches the band, they're like, fuck it, we don't want to learn anything new.
we ended up doing like all the biggest hits. And because of that, like my episode was the one that everybody wanted to watch. It was just a lucky coincidence that I got to.
I know,
because
I looked him up and I'm like, oh, he's doing I Can't Go For That. And there's Daryl Hall there, and he's a big fan. You're a big fan of Daryl Hall & Oates. I'm like, that's fucking cool.
It was super cool. Yeah. And he was such a sweetheart. And we talked about vinyl records and shit. It was very cool.
Right.
The little off-camera convos were very cool. I will never forget that experience for sure.
Yeah. Did you learn anything in particular with something that stands out for you from that that experience with him being such a major influence for you?
It was cool just getting to talk to him about like his early days in Philly. And he was in this group, in a doo-wop group in Philly called the Temp Tones.
Oh, really?
That were basically like a bootleg Temptations or the Four Tops or something.
Uh-huh.
And just like hearing about all that and his influences and the way he grew up listening to Tom Bell and a lot of the things that I just think are the best, you know, things ever in soul music. You know, that Philly sound is really the moments and the whatnots and all the Tom Bell, the Delphonics, and like, you know, the stylistics. Like, that's the shit that really gets me. It's just my favorite stuff ever.
Yeah. So let's go back to your putting the band together, getting on the road, you know? So you were going to talk about how, you know, where that went, how that happened, and what your sort of,
we hit
that whole thing.
We ended up doing so many live dates. I mean, I remember there were years where like I barely saw my house or my friends, or like, we would do like over 200 shows a year, which is just psychotic. And I definitely was having so much fun, and it was so cool getting to like travel so much and see so much of the world. Yeah. And I really, really love traveling, and that part of it was so cool to me. And just getting to experience all that was like so cool. I mean, just what an amazing thing to be able to do for a living. But I got burnt on touring, you know, and doing,
yeah,
it's very hard on your body.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask you how that's going now. It's like, man, everyone goes out of the box, like really hard.
My knees are so bad. And I was like, you know, in the early days, you're loading all your own equipment in and out. And like,
it's the athlete in high school, man. I was a hardcore fucking athlete, man. My body's been shot over the years because I went so hard for so long.
Yeah.
Is that where the knees are coming from? Like just the basketball knees and the soccer. Are done. And like,
yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah. It's very tough.
Add skiing into that mix too for me. And I'm like,
now my back hurts from sleeping on the mat, little thin mattress in the tour bus. And it's a hard life, man.
Let me get out my violin, man.
Yeah, for sure. World's smallest violin. Right. Yeah. So many Tupac, so many tears, harmonica, but it's I don't like to complain about it because you just sound like an asshole, but
touring. I always couch that in the fact that it is really difficult. And I like to get perspectives from artists about what it's like to be out there on the road and how that's kind of shaped your own career and experience.
Yeah. I mean, especially early on when you're in a minivan, you're driving yourself, you know, from from gig to gig, and then you're getting out of the van after driving for 7 hours. You're getting out of the van and loading all your own equipment in and out,
let's hear it for Youth, though, huh?
Everybody, yeah, for sure. Oh my God, thank God for Youth. Yeah. It's just stuff that you can only do when you're young. But we were having so much fun doing it. We didn't care at the time. We were just like, this is amazing, and. Yeah, but I would always just laugh. Like it still happens every single time I go on tour. Now I'll hit my friends up in Chicago or, you know, Denver or wherever. I'll be like, hey, I'm in town. You want to come to the show? And that never fails. They will always hit me back and say, oh, cool. How long are you in town for? Are you going to go?
right.
Going to go see this thing? And, you're gonna do, you know, get out and ski for a bit or whatever, and I'm like, yo,
I'm on tour, dude.
You don't get it, man. This is not, we're not on vacation here, man. Like,
right?
We see the back of the venue, and that's it.
I think they're basically say, if you read between the lines on that, it's like contact your friends sometimes.
Yeah, well, man, that's hard. That's another side of touring that. It's tough is you don't get to see your people that you love that as much as you want.
Right.
It's a lonely biz, man.
How are you kind of strategizing as to what that's going to look like? I noticed you got a tour that's coming up starting January 16th. You're doing California, making it out to like Texas, Dallas and Austin.
Yeah.
Midwest, East Coast. And you're coming all the way back to California at the end. And that could be, is tour, that like the big hurrah, last hurrah? It's the, this is my tour, this the pre-baby tour. What's going to be the name of this one?
This is definitely the pre-baby tour. I should have called it the pre-baby tour. Maybe I will just pivot and call it the pre-baby tour.
You can, yeah.
But you'll notice that it is a very compact schedule and that is very intentional because I need to be back in time for my baby to come into the world. So
and
that's not something I need. I want to play around with, man. I need to be here for that.
Oh, hell yeah.
It does really affect the way that, you know, being married now and having a nice house in LA and not wanting to leave. It's like, it makes it harder to go out on the road and do as many shows. But
do you get worried about getting into the comfort zone and not wanting to tour as much? Do you feel pressure? Like, where's your head out from? Well, shit, you know, I'm a multi-Grammy nominated artist. I've done X, Y, and Z. I've been out there. I've got 7 albums, however many, at least, you know, this is where I'm at now. I'm having a baby.
I mean, just seeing like James Brown do it at 70 years old and watching Donald Fagen even now, like, still going out and touring more than he ever did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I hope that I am still doing this shit when I'm 70 years old. Like, I really do hope that I'm going out and on tour and performing on stage when I'm 70. I love it. I really do love it. And I don't know. Yeah, I hope I'm able to hang on and keep doing it. But yeah, we'll see. You just never know.
Yeah. Since we're talking about touring, I wanted to go back briefly to Amy Winehouse. I was doing a little bit of a deep dive on Nile Rodgers and some disco and funk and soul, and sort of that veered over into Amy Winehouse, watching some of her older performances and a few interviews. Such a sad story. She was so incredibly talented. What was that like to be out on tour? So you were out on tour with her, and was it 08 time frame or so? I don't know what that was.
This was 2010, I think.
Oh, okay.
And we were in Brazil, actually. It was her last tour before she passed away.
So you were only on that tour in Brazil?
I was only on the one in Brazil. That was the only one I got to do. We did like 5 or 6 dates in Brazil.
Did you have much contact with her? Did you get a feel for what she was like, or?
Not a ton, but she did. She would come and like say hi and hang out for a bit. She was, anytime, you know, she would talk to me or the band, she was like the absolute sweetest sweetheart in the world. She was just like a total sweetheart. And it was definitely the saddest thing ever to just see, like to watch her live on stage was a miraculous experience. It was otherworldly. She was so special. And then to see her just struggle so much off stage with, you know, substance abuse, it was really, really, really tragic and sad. But the moments that she was on stage, it was, you know, when she would open her mouth and sing, it was revelatory.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like it still. I mean, it was so powerful.
Yeah, just simply amazing. I mean, Janis Joplin comes to mind, and like Amy Winehouse was 27 also. Yeah.
And I'm grateful that I got to witness that. And, you know, even for as little time as it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So anyway, you're going out on tour. Let's brainstorm another name for this tour. Like pre-baby. That's kind of like, I don't know.
The tour does have
prenatal,
an official name. The tour does actually have an official name. It's called Hawthorne Rides Again.
Nice.
And it is, just in the U.S. right now. But we're hoping to, after the baby comes, we're going to hopefully do get like back out at some point and do some other dates, maybe in Europe or wherever.
Have you had experience with baby? Are you an Uncle Andrew?
I am an uncle. Yeah. I'm an uncle twice over. So yeah, I mean, that has been like such a great experience. I mean, being an uncle, I don't know if you're an uncle also, but
I am. Yeah. My sister has twins.
Being an uncle is the best because
it's all the upside.
You get to just, it's all the fun and none of the work. You just say, all right, cool. See you guys.
Well, later. The only downside from being an uncle is that it was happening at the same time when I had my kids. So I really didn't spend a lot of time when they were like as much time as I would if they were little.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. I got to be an uncle first, which was very cool for a while. And then, now I'm going to transition into being a dad of my own. So
Yeah, that's great, man. That's great. I'm really looking forward to this new to the tour. You're coming through Chicago, I think, on February 3rd to Park West, which is a really cool venue. I don't know if you're
familiar. One of my favorite venues. I played Park West a few times now, and I love the setup of it. It's so cool.
Yeah,
Chicago is always such a great place to go perform to. I mean, and I. Just, you know, growing up we used to drive to Chicago all the time.
Oh, for sure. Right.
It was 4 hours by car from Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And
still is.
yeah. Still is. And just like, man, I was very, very into like the ghetto house and ghetto techno that was coming out of Chicago, like DJ Sluggo and DJ Dion and there was like a bunch of amazing house music coming out of Chicago that we would get it in Detroit. And it was just so cool and unique.
Yeah.
And I just remember like being in clubs in Chicago and somebody throwing on Is It All Over My Face, and everybody in the Chicago club, everybody instinctively knew when the song said Is It All Over My Face, everybody in the crowd would go hell yeah. It's like a big unified group, and I was like so blown away by how cool that was.
So it's just kind of like matched your vibe, like historically.
Man, it was just such a powerful scene there that mm-hmm. was so cool to witness. Yeah. And then, Chicago, Curtis Mayfield and Leroy Hudson and, you know, some of my favorite soul music too. It's such a great town.
Yeah. Hell yeah. I mean, also for the blues and rock. I mean, I live right up the street from Chess Records on South Michigan Avenue.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fucking amazing.
What was the Cadillac Records?
Yeah.
The movie they did was such a great movie. I love that movie. With Howlin' Wolf and yeah, that shit was amazing.
Oh yeah, jeez. When I was Keith Richards, when he first landed in Chicago in like 1960 something, he's like told the cab driver, and he recounts this in his book. He's like, "Take me to Chess Records.
Take me to Chess." Yeah. Leonard Chess, right?
Yeah.
Very cool.
Your latest album is amazing. This is the Hawthorne, what is it? Hawthorne Rides Again.
Hawthorne Rides Again is the tour.
Yeah. The album for all time.
For all time.
Yeah. Love it. And is this a departure? You said you're out there saying, like, I took a bunch of mushrooms and this is my most psychedelic album. I really like that album, you know, kind of learning about you now a little bit more. I really appreciate that direction. Tell me a little bit before I let you go. Tell me a little bit about that, the sort of vibe and where we're at right now with that and what that means to you.
Yeah, it's definitely my most psychedelic record yet. I've been very just, you know, as I get deeper and deeper into vinyl record collecting and just learning about different styles of music and traveling the world.
Yeah.
I've become like more and more into, you know, more psychedelic music, more, you know, getting deeper into jazz from other countries, jazz from Turkey, jazz from Ethiopia, and you know, psychedelic rock bands like Can and whatever, Jefferson Airplane, whoever.
Yeah.
And just like Frank Zappa.
Oh,
Frank,
shit.
I love Frank Zappa. And it slowly has just like worked its way more and more into my own music. I think as I got away from the major label thing too, it freed me. Mm. It really liberated me. And as I started writing and producing more for other artists,
mm-hmm.
like Doja Cat and Jordan Ward or Blue the Tiger or whoever, it has really freed me. It's liberated my own music to be able to really go out there and just do some weirder, more experimental things.
Liberated in the sense that's given you sort of the license to be more free with the direction you're going. Because I was kind of thinking, I was going to ask you, you're into so many different genres and you can touch upon so many different things that are already ingrained in your mind. How do you release from that? Or do you even try it?
At this point in my career, you know, this is my sixth studio album, mm-hmm. I think sixth solo album. I feel like at this point I have my, you know, group of people that are checking for me and I'm like, you know, I have my, you know, the Wine and Vinyl Collectors Club, and I've got, you know, my, you know, songs that I've written for other bigger, way bigger artists than me.
Mm.
I just feel like I'm at a place where I don't have to worry about making hits anymore for myself.
And I can
just take more chances.
Do what the fuck you want, in other words.
I can do whatever the fuck I want. Fantastic, I can make my with the music that's as weird as I want. And I'm not really that worried about it. And, you know, everybody liking it now.
Yeah. Yeah. Did
which is a really cool place to be.
That feels liberating from kind of where you were before.
And yeah, it really does. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of pressure, especially when you have something that's commercially successful. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pressure to keep cranking out things that are popular.
Yeah.
And, you know, once you can kind of, you know, and when I was recording the first album, I wasn't thinking about any of that. I was just making shit that I thought was cool.
Yeah.
And it's nice to be able to get back to just only worrying about, do I think this is cool?
Right. Right. So that you, yeah. So it really is liberating. It's not.
Yeah.
And having that amazing background and knowledge of music is a plus, is an incredible part of who you are as a creative artist. But
yeah,
having that confidence and just kind of knowing that you can go in the direction that you want to go, sort of where you want to be at. You're at a super fucking amazing place right now.
Yeah, it's been really fun. And, you know, I just got married. I'm having my first kid. So it's a crazy time in my life. I got a lot to write about.
Yeah.
A lot of great things to write about. I mean, in this new album is definitely all about getting people in the mood for love, which is also such a fun thing and such a cool thing. And that's what the tour is going to be all about.
Yeah. And that's good. Cause I forget the name of the song that I threw on from one of your early albums. It was about breaking up. And then I was reading about how this new album was about, I just happened to like just throw on one of the tracks and it was like, and then I was reading about the new album is like a beautiful album about me meeting my wife, et cetera, and how happy I am now. And I was like, oh, good for this motherfucker, man. That's awesome. I love that. Yeah. Yeah. Shit does it's come around. Songs. Yeah.
It's love songs, and that's the most timeless music there is love songs. I mean, so,
right.
You know, that's always going to be something that is in demand, you know?
Right. Right.
So yeah, it's very cool. I mean, early on in my career. Yeah. A lot of my songs that I was kind of known for like the bitter breakup song.
Well, were you having bitter breakups?
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, I was documenting my struggle to find love in real time.
Mm.
And LA especially can be like a very lonely, rough place to date.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you didn't have any problems meeting people, right? But you just weren't meeting the right people.
Sometimes.
Come on, man. I mean, you're like, they're throwing themselves at you. Let's go.
Yeah, man. You'd be surprised. Yeah, yeah. No, it was not always like that.
Really?
Yeah, no, it's LA can be tough, man. It's a crazy place. But yeah, now it's very cool to be on the other side of that writing about being in love and you know, if there is anything that I was thinking about as far as like from like how is the listener gonna feel about this record? I wanted to make sure that it was something that was going to get everybody else in the mood for love.
Nice. Nice. Well, I think you accomplished that, man. Totally. I'm excited for you. I'm excited for
you. Thanks, Josh.
Yeah. It's really great. Thanks for spending the time, man.
Man, my pleasure. It's good talking to you.
Yeah. Been really fucking cool. Thanks so much for being here, brother.
We'll see you in Chicago.
Absolutely. Cheers.
All right, man. Peace and love.
Yeah. Same to you.
Peace and love.
Okay, that was me talking to Mayor Hawthorne. I just really ended up really liking this guy. I mean, he's got such an interesting background coming up from Detroit, DJing, meeting that producer at a party in Los Angeles, and that became incredibly fundamental for his development as an artist and for his career at the time. But, you know, going back to when he was a kid collecting albums, he was an athlete. He said he was playing basketball, soccer, just into so many different worlds. And as myself, somebody who's been like that in and out of different worlds and with so many varied interests that I have, I really resonated with that part of Mayer's background. So he's just coming off of this Hawthorne Rides Again tour and concluding that on the West Coast, which is great timing for him. Like we talked about at length, he's embarking into the world of fatherhood. So congratulations to Mayer for that in advance. We joked about this being the pre-baby tour, the prenatal tour as well. So, you know, good timing with the tour. He's going to get home and enjoy that part, that new part of life. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what's going to come out of that creatively for Mayer. I'm sure it's going to be something that's so amazing. And I love his love of Steely Dan as well. I am an unabashed lover of Steely Dan, which can be controversial, but, you know, everything's subjective. And I just love Steely Dan as well. Frank Zappa as well. And his stories about Hall & Oates and being on Daryl's House, the Live from Daryl's House, which is an amazing series, as well as opening for them at Madison Square Garden. Just great stories. And he's just an incredible road warrior. They were playing 200 plus shows on the road in his early days. And, you know, he speaks about taking more chances now. You know, he feels like he's at a really good place in his life, that he's kind of at another level now. He's felt liberated and he's able to really to be able to create with no pressure. And that's been a long time coming for him. You know, he's gone from breakup songs to love songs on this recent album For All Time. So, you know, it's a really great time for Mayer. I really felt that, and I'm so glad to be able to have connected with him and bring you this conversation. It's such a pivotal time in his life and just an important time for him. I mentioned that I had seen him recently at Park West in Chicago, and one really cool thing that I wanted to mention that happened during the show. I don't know, it was about a third of the way through the show. He stopped and talked to the people up in the front rows, like two or three rows back in the pit, and talked about, he said, okay, we're going to take a minute or two right now. You guys take out your phones, take all the pictures of me you want. He sort of posed, and they, and the rest of the band posed as well. And he said, take these pictures, then just put your phone away, people. Just be in the moment. And of course, everyone, so they took out their phones and took the pictures, but everyone in the venue cheered. And, you know, it was just a really good moment, you know, to just remind everybody to be in the moment, that you don't need to be taking pictures the entire time. And, you know, I'm not necessarily guilty of that. I'd like to take a couple pictures here and there, but yeah, I think that was a really good moment and kind of more of a reflection of a trend of artists that are, you know, not even allowing phones into the venue. So just something I wanted to mention about the vibe at his show, which was a really great show. Anyway, thanks so much for being here for this episode with Mayer Hawthorne. I hope you really enjoyed this this interview as much as I did. Thanks again for being here. And I want to send a very special thank you and shout out to Mayer Hawthorne for being here on this episode of Road Case. Thanks again so much for listening. And I'd like to encourage everyone to get involved with Road Case. You can do so in a number of different ways. You can email me at info@roadcasepod.com with questions, comments, and even suggestions for guests. Or you can follow us on the socials, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at Road Case Pod. And we have a YouTube channel called Road Case Podcast. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite listening platform. And if you could please rate and review the podcast while you're there, that would be great. So I want to thank Waltzer for this awesome theme music that we have. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening to Road Case. We have a lot of great episodes coming up, so I'll see you on down the road.